It's sweltering in Studio A. Might need to turn on the air, Kyle. Get away with it, because Tony's a proper broadcaster. He likes to chat, Tony. We'll turn on the aircon. There's nothing I can tell you about Tony Gosling you don't know. He's an author, a journalist, a radio presenter based in Bristol. His Friday evening radio show is not to be missed. It is known as Not the BCFM Politics Show, 5 to 8. Check it out. Welcome back, Tony Gosling. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Yeah, I'm quite happy because I noticed this over the weekend and this week. What I try and do when we finish our musical break halfway through the show I do every Friday, I try to start the second part with what I think is the big story of the moment that the press haven't quite realised how big it is yet. And I'm very pleased to see the aid now slowly at least starting to get into Gaza, because I'm quite convinced that Britain is far more influential over the affairs of what happens over there than people realise. Everyone's focuses on the United States, but last week Lammy got an absolute pasting, not by Jeremy Corbyn, who's quite good, but by Kit Malthouse, the Tory MP, talking about him going to the, you know, Lammy ending up in The Hague, etc. And it's this sort of thing which I think has big echoes and effect on what happens in Gaza. So finally, at last, the Israelis are being persuaded by, I think, by the Foreign Office and by diplomatic pressure from Britain to, you know, the threat is, of course, the Brits might not support them. And that's one of the things that I think that scares Netanyahu more than anything else.
Did Malthouse really hammer Lammy? He must have some sort of split personality. Can I play you a quick clip? Let me play you Malthouse speaking about Gaza a couple of weeks ago.
As the Honourable Lady indicated, we're all frankly getting a bit fed up with the theatrics in this chamber. And if I'm honest with the Minister, it feels like the whole house is being played. He shows up, he mouths the words, full of condemnation and being appalled. And very occasionally the government leaks out just enough sanctions, frankly, I'm afraid, colleagues, to keep the Labour benches from open revolt. And yet, since he last appeared, as others have mentioned, 22 new settlements announced, and the Israeli government has replaced the UNRWA distribution system with a shooting gallery, an abattoir.
Jesus Christ, Tony. He called it a shooting gallery and an abattoir, and now he's criticising Lammy. Is he mad, Kit Malthouse?
Well, no, he's not. He seems to be leading the charge from the actual opposition. Of course, the shadow cabinet are hopeless and useless, pretty ineffective in really holding their feet to the fire, because, of course, they're all part of the Uniparty, World Economic Forum fans. But no, he's done quite a good job there. Last week's intervention, I think it was during Foreign Office questions, was really, I mean, it was brilliant. He was saying, look, we have to, I cannot appeal to you, Lammy, anymore. I have to appeal to your backbenchers to get rid of you and to put pressure on you because, you know, they're part of the government party and we're not. And words are not enough, and words are getting us nowhere. But he was also talking about Lammy going to The Hague. You know, these sorts of things put enormous pressure, political pressure. And not only that, the wonderful Jeremy Corbyn. Look, I know you don't like him.
Oh, stop, T.
But he's finally got his act together a bit in order to actually rattle Starmer, with hundreds of thousands, I hear, over the weekend of people immediately sort of just signing up and joining his party. For, I think it's,
you know what he's going to do, T? You know what he's going to do? He's going to waltz Nigel Farage through the doors of number 10 Downing Street.
Well, maybe. I honestly think Farage's party are extremely professional. But the point is,
Lee Anderson is
focusing on Starmer and focusing on this crooked genocidalist. You know, we've just had this situation in Bristol here last weekend where 17 people were arrested for saying they supported Palestine Action. The police finally gave up. There was an elderly couple in their 80s. And the police just said, oh, look, you know, please just, you know, just let's give us your signs. We're not going to arrest you. So, you know, what's happening is the resolve of the establishment. And these police are human beings. They don't want to be arresting old ladies trying to stop a genocide.
Yeah.
So the pressure is coming to bear on people like the moronic Yvette Cooper and Starmer and Lammy. Lammy is supporting apartheid, right? A black guy supporting apartheid. Starmer's a human rights lawyer supporting a genocide. You know, I think they're starting to crumble, Richie.
I wanted to ask you, did you happen to hear what Julia Hartley Brewer said on talk radio this morning as a radio presenter? And you're about one of about five journalists left in the country. I'm not including myself in that. I'm a commentator these days. I try to employ the ethics and the standards of real journalism, but I do too much commentary. You're a journalist. This is the worst thing I've ever heard in my 30-year career. Do you want to hear this? This is Julie Hartley Brewer this morning talking about the malnutrition.
A lot of those pictures are propaganda. Yeah. They're of children. Yeah. It's been proved, a number of them. These are children who have some congenital, horrible disease, totally unrelated to lack of food.
Yeah. Now, Tony, the children that we're seeing on Facebook and on Twitter uploaded videos by their family members that looked like they walked out of Auschwitz. Those children have congenital problems, Tony. You crazy conspiracy theory bastard, you. They're not starving at all, Tony, according to Julia Hartley Brewer.
Well, look, the Rupert Murdoch empire, ever since I've been, I suppose, even beginning to think as a teenager, has been an evil empire. In Wapping, they got rid of the print unions and brought in the electricians, and they smashed the unions within journalism, within the profession. Not so much the NUJ who went along with it, the journalists union, but the print unions were absolutely solid. They were brilliant, and they actually supported the left wing journalists. Whereas, so Murdoch started like that. You know, he managed to buy up the Times and the Sun very cheap, and he's now the genocidalist. It really like the Big Brother transmitter that's transmitting all of every part of his output is pro-Israeli, pro-genocide. So really this stuff is, and actually I was very, very pleased to know a lovely guy called Louis Sherwood here in Bristol, who for a while was a master of the Merchant Venturers, who the City Illuminati, right from the times of the John Cabot trip to discover North America, who sailed from Bristol. It's a Royal Charter organisation that's still here, very much running everything from behind the scenes. And Louis was a really lovely guy. And I remember getting a lift in the car. I mentioned Rupert Murdoch, and he actually jammed the brakes on, smashed his fist onto the dashboard and said, "Don't ever mention that man's name in my presence." Louis happened to be the chairman of HTV at the time. And he was one of the people who were behind the drama series that HTV used to make. That's the local ITV franchise.
In Wales, no?
And so everybody in the profession who knows anything knows that Murdoch is poison. If we were to sack or imprison, I mean, in fact, imprison is not beyond the pale, because many of these journalists and editors have been cheerleading the genocide, as Julia Hartley Brewer was just doing. In Nazi Germany, at the end of the Second World War, the editors of the Der Stürmer and the other German newspapers were all executed. So maybe Julia Hartley Brewer.
No, we're not going to be executing idiots like Julia Hartley Brewer.
Same road. Maybe David Lammy could. You know, these people who are supporting genocide. I think this is one of the things that the lawyers in the Foreign Office are starting to realise. This could be deadly serious down the road.
I misunderstood, I think, earlier on what you said about Kit Malthouse. I thought Kit Malthouse was hammering Lammy because Lammy has been talking about a two-state solution and all the rest of it. I've misunderstood
this.
Right, so Malthouse is criticising Lammy for not going far enough.
Palestinians have got nothing to have a state with at the moment.
No, there's nothing there.
What's the point of even talking about this?
Well, that's a great question. What is the point of even talking about this? Because if Israel withdraws all of its troops and takes its planes and these drones out of the sky today and for good, 25 years before Gaza is habitable again, right?
Well, yeah. But I mean, the thing is, it all seems to me to just be another. I mean, this is all, I think, managed by the Israelis and by their supporters in the London media, like Murdoch. They all sit and they manage this very carefully. As it looks like something might start to bite, like, for example, the pictures of these starving. I mean, the Daily Express cover last week was brilliant to see all over the country, you know, the picture of starving kids. And this is very important, that people see all this stuff, and to particularly for it to come from a right-wing paper.
Do you think people care, Tony, well read. In the UK? Do you think enough people in this country care today?
Well, you know what? I think people who do care about things like that are those people at the Foreign Office and at the Israeli embassy. You know, they're the ones that are getting scared. So their tactic is, let's shift everything away from the starving kids and let's propose a two-state solution. Let's get everyone talking about it's what is called propaganda. It's just shifting the news agenda onto something which is nothing to do with what it was yesterday or last night. And they failed to do that, I think, because they've tried. A lot of the Murdoch Empire, for example, are talking about it. But the real solution to all of this has got to be, hasn't it? I mean, I'm looking at it now with all these starving people. I'm in touch with people in Gaza. Is we've got to have some sort of UN peacekeeping force. And it seems to me, Richie, the only people who are actually literally putting economic and military pressure on the Israelis to stop this are the Yemenis, of all people, who we've just had this like massive war against with British the British Air Force support actually over in Saudi Arabia helping to bomb Yemen, and something like 700,000 or 800,000 Yemenis have died, but they're still doing more now to stop the genocide than anybody else on the planet, it seems to me. What about China? What the hell are they up to? They're doing nothing.
No interest in it. Just for listeners who might, this being a Monday, might not have been following events over the last few days, the UN Food Programme has said a third of Gazans haven't eaten for days. The US President Donald Trump is in Scotland. He met Keir Starmer earlier on. He said Gaza is experiencing real starvation and that the US will set up food centres. But the UN's aid chief said after this, he said that this would only be a drop in the ocean. Apparently, Tony, one of the problems is infrastructure. The roads are gone. The roads are completely gone there. So getting trucks into where trucks are needed to get is proving to be very difficult. And this is why they're talking about parachuting aid in.
Don't the Israelis have some bulldozers? I think they do. Look, the point is, these aid agencies need to just be able to operate. At the moment, the problem is that the aid has simply not been allowed in. And the Israelis' tactic to deal with this seems to be simply to lie. Lie, all the way through. Just come out with another story. Oh, look at all these aid trucks. They're inside Gaza. And it's just that Hamas won't let them move around. These are all the sorts of weaselly excuses that they come up with.
Yeah, but hang on. A broken clock is right twice a day. So Julie Hartley Brewer is a buffoon, a clown, right? A comical alley type. That's what she is. No
a
doubt
weasel.
About it.
She's a weasel.
But however, Hamas are no angels either. Is there even some truth to claims that Hamas operatives or fighters are taking food away? Is there any truth to that?
Look, they may be. I honestly, I'm not there.
I don't know either.
And the contacts I've got don't know either. But the fact of the matter is Hamas are not stopping aid convoys getting in. The Israelis are doing that. I think, you know, it's just pretty simple, isn't it? So everyone's trying to say, oh, this is one of the things we are taught as journalists. All of us should be balance, right? You give both sides. But when one side is a genocidalist and when one side is lying all the time, you've got to actually take that into account. I mean, you know, go back to the death camps of the Nazis. Are you supposed to be balanced? Give the Nazi point of view. Oh, but we need to actually, you know, but there isn't enough food in the country. We're very sorry. These people have to starve. Well, also, we need cheap labor. We are fighting a war, you know. And so the SS, it's better that the SS look after these laborers, you know. So are you going to try and give both sides in that case?
Yeah, but wouldn't you, as an inquisitive man, wouldn't you have loved to have interviewed some of the commandants of some of these death camps before they were executed? Wouldn't you have loved to have been in a position to try and get inside the mind of a man who might have had a pretty ordinary, unremarkable upbringing and yet found himself overseeing the machine gunning to death of hundreds of Jewish people or the burning to death? I'd love to have gotten into the heads of these people.
I'd love to be able to quiz them. The modern equivalent, of course, are people like the British Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, who the Declassified UK people managed to doorstep last week. He didn't have anything to say. He just shuffled from some Air Force, collective Air Forces meeting into his car and ran away. When Phil Miller, the editor of a Declassified UK, shoved a microphone under his nose. So these people are cowards, Richie. Look at the Air Chief Marshal of the UK. He's got nothing to say about his aircraft being used as reconnaissance for genocide.
He just
runs away and dives into a car like a little weasel, like Julia Hartley Brewer. Only he's not saying anything. But what they're all doing is complicity in genocide. And actually, the fact is, all of these people, it seems to me, are either control freaks, complete psychopaths, or else they're people like Britain's top Air Force officer, you know, Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, who's just a coward. And he's been put in that position because he's a coward and because he refuses to question. For a start, he won't face the press at all. And when he does, it will only be with a nice little cosy interview with someone like Robert Peston. But he will not face questions from anyone that's going to actually ask him something awkward. These people are absolutely useless. He's not Mr. Dowding, who was in charge of bombing in the Second World War, or the fighter chief, whoever he was. These people will not face basic, simple questions that any democratic country press will ask them, including, by the way, I would have liked Phil Miller to just ask him, do you believe in democracy, sir? You know, what do you think about democracy? Does it exist in this country? Do you think that it's OK? I mean, he was asking me about the genocide, but is this guy a Democrat? No, he's a fascist.
Speaking of questions that people don't want to ask, I'll ask you one, but I think you'll answer it. Is it a coincidence? Is it cronyism? Or is it something more sinister that when you look at political broadcasting in the UK, there are a lot of Jewish broadcasters? Like, I'm thinking Robert Peston, I'm thinking Nick Robinson on the Today programme, I'm thinking Laura Kunzberg, I'm thinking your woman from Manchester whose father was a brothel keeper. Her name will come to me in a moment. I asked a friend of mine who's very much pro-Zionist. Yeah, I can have friends who are pro-Zionist. I asked a friend of mine, what do you think of all these Jewish broadcasters? And is it very wrong of me to ask the question, maybe these Jewish broadcasters are privately appalled and sickened by the genocide? And why should they have to apologise for it anyway? They don't live in Israel. But is it a coincidence so many prominent broadcasters in politics, Jewish people, or cronyism or something else?
Well, in my experience, much of the Jewish education is fantastic, superb. I got to know George Monbiot extremely well. He's Jewish, and he was incredibly intelligent, incredibly well educated, and that's part of all of this, I think, is education. You know, when people get a really good education, and they have from whatever background they come from, they have a kind of academic bent. They're able to articulate themselves well. This is what tends to happen. If they're from a wealthy class, they get put into private school, you know, go to Oxford University, things like that, like George did. But it annoys me that they've got rid of the grammar schools, because that was the whole point of that after World War II, was putting people into, so kids from council estates who turned out to be quite good at maths or English or whatever at school went on to do their O levels, their A levels, and then they went, you know, through a grammar school to do all that. After the 11 plus. So kids who are academically good had that opportunity too. In fact, what's his name? Mervyn King, who was the governor of the Bank of England. Remember him? He went to a grammar school and he was the son of a railway porter. Now, that's the kind of country that I grew up in and I want to carry on in some way. That is where people get ahead because of their merit, because they're actually good at what they do. Not like this weaselly Sir Rich Knighton, head of the Air Chief Marshal, you know, of the British Royal Air Force, who are now behaving like the Luftwaffe, basically. Intelligence, I think, is a lot of these Jewish people are very intelligent people, and therefore they gravitate towards the press. But I think there probably is some favouritism as well. I mean, nepotism is bound to happen in these sorts of industries, yeah, nepotism, in any industry, word, any profession.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair. It's a good question. Tony Gosling is our guest. A couple of, as usual, you inspire comment from our listeners. Joe says, don't forget Hamas is the democratically elected government in Gaza. Well, James has been on to say, this is really interesting from James, maybe people don't care because they equate Palestinians with grooming gangs simply because they are Muslim. That's from James. What do you say to that?
It's the terminology grooming gangs. I did interview John Wedger about this, who I find one of the most articulate former police officers, particularly because he successfully got prosecuted people who had been pimping out kids in London, which is not an easy thing to do because there's a sort of establishment set up within the Metropolitan Police that protects these people. And he explained this term grooming gangs is something that they never used. This is a press term, really. And the idea is it's a sort of dog whistle reference to Islamic, you know, ethnically Asian people, not necessarily Muslims at all, you know. So are they religious? No, you know, not necessarily at all. So he was really just said, actually, the real term is just, is anyone involved in
hang on. He must be wrong there. Listen, I admire John Wedger. I've interviewed him as well. I know you know him better. But he's got to be wrong there. It's a preposterous claim to make that they're not religious. The great majority of British Asians and British Asian men attend mosque services. The great majority of them.
The Hindus?
But no, we're talking about British Pakistani.
Right. But there are Indians in these gangs as well, aren't there? I mean, they're not just Pakistani gangs at all. So anyway, you shouldn't be referring to these people by their religion, but by their ethnicity, maybe. And also, my experience of Muslims is they would be absolutely run a million miles. I mean, this is my neighbours I'm talking about in Bristol here. From anything to do with child prostitution. So what you're doing is you're tarring someone like Tommy Robinson does with a religious brush who is actually just of an ethnicity that you're trying to demonize.
Yeah, but I'm not doing that at all. Let me make my position really clear. What we saw in Rochdale and Rotherham were young British Pakistani men trafficking girls. And these guys attended their local mosque services, the majority of them. I mean, this is a fact, right? And we know that these guys were allowed.
It is.
Hang on. It is. Let me finish before you come back. Let me finish. We know that these guys.
People that attend mosque aren't always believers in the faith, are they?
I never said that. I'm not stupid.
They get a lot of pressure to do so.
Yeah, but they do. We have seen a massive decline in white British and white Irish people attending church services. Not so in this particular demographic. The point I'm making here is these guys operated and they operated together. All of this stuff was very close-knit. It was British Asians, Muslims. This is how they would have identified. And they were allowed to do the things they did, particularly in places like Oldham, because local authorities run by Labour thought this is our vote, basically. And we don't want to upset that applicant.
Well, I disagree with you completely.
We have evidence of
it. I don't think they identify as Muslim. They identify as Pakistani, maybe, Pakistani origin. But this attempt to... I mean, you're Irish. You know how so much of the problems in Northern Ireland. They try to say this is a Protestant group. This terrorist group is a Protestant group. And they're trying to use the religious brush on these people in order to really just dirty up the religion and get people hating each other or hating people of faith.
Can I make a quick comment and then I'll shut up, Tony?
As we know with Zionism and the Judaism.
Fair enough. Let me make a quick comment and then you can have, if you want 10 minutes to answer this, you can have 10 minutes.
Okay.
My listeners will be screaming at you and me. They will be saying, and I understand this, they will be saying, they will be saying, in their opinion, it is religious in nature, at least some part of it. Let me finish now. They will say that these guys, through their cultural belief system, through their religion, they believe that these young white British girls who might have smoked, who might have drank, that these were fallen, that these were worthless children, and therefore they were fair game for anything. Now, there is some evidence of this, and that is certainly tied into their identity. And our listeners will be saying, you can't dismiss that. Richie's dismissed it before. Don't let Tony Gosling dismiss it.
Yeah, well, we've just spent far too long, it seems to me, talking about Pakistani gangs, where actually you've got some very high-level prostitution going on in all the big cities, particularly in the south of England, with white kids involved and white men and women involved in it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there's a bit of a game being played here by the press, largely the Murdoch press, actually, and I think some of the others too, which is to try to make out that this is a Muslim problem. It's not. You know, it's a very wide problem in society, and it's come from the permissive society. It's also come from George Osborne.
But why import it, Tony?
George Osborne said it's okay to include all these figures from prostitution on your balance sheet as a private business, and that it's all part of GDP now, just as he did with drug criminals.
Let me give you two comments here. Hang on, let me give you two comments. Colin says Tony should know that in Bristol it is Somalians and Eritreans predominantly, also known as Muslims. And before you answer Colin, there are people listening to this who will say, of course, the majority of abusers in the country will be white British, but they will say, why import it? Why open the doors to small boats coming in here with lots of young men who might come from very socially conservative backgrounds?
The small boats is deliberate. Yeah. It's all deliberate, the small boats. The idea is to keep the house price bubble going up, and also loads and loads of cheap labour for industry. But anyway, look, I did want to talk a bit about, if you don't mind, about the 80th anniversary of the nuclear bombs being dropped. Which was, I think, a mega little item we had on Friday. We had the local Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament people in, who are holding these vigils here in Bristol. Many cities around the world and across the country will be doing it on the 6th of August and the 9th of August. It's 80 years since Hiroshima and Nagasaki were nuked. And I think, for me, the big take-home now is come from this guy, Todd Ryder, in the United States, who's been doing decades of research. He's been putting all this stuff together now that proves that the bombs that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima were developed in Germany. The basic designs were Nazi designs. The SS had their nuclear bomb committee in 1942. They were designing this. This is 3 years before the end of the Second World War. And they had everyone knows the atom was first split in Berlin in the 1930s. This was a technology which was developed by the Nazis. At the end of the war, there was quiet little deals were done with enriched uranium and all these techniques that the Nazis had developed to make plutonium bombs explode, which are quite difficult things to make go bang. And the first ever test, Trinity test, was a plutonium bomb, which was using Nazi technology. In the desert, and then the first was a uranium bomb, the Hiroshima one, and the second one, the Nagasaki, that was another plutonium bomb. So this was a highly advanced technology, and we need to understand, I think, now, and begin to get...
Why does it matter to you? Hang on. You have talked about this extensively on this programme before, right? So listeners are not unfamiliar with this, and they are noting already that you refuse to answer my previous question about the boats and the young men.
Answer any question you ask me. Go again.
Well, it's that whole problem of we see it in Epping and Essex, we see it elsewhere in the country, where you take a hotel and Serco or somebody else pays the hotel owners maybe a considerable amount of money to say, we'll take over your property, we'll manage it, we'll put migrants in there. And they're, in some cases, instantly there is an issue in terms of there is an increase in assaults against girls in the town immediately. People turn up to protest against it, and you get the police and you get Antifa. So there are people saying, look, Colin, for one, Lucy is another one saying, you're being disingenuous. You know, there seems to be a problem with a cultural issue with some of these young men from some of these backgrounds.
It's not a cultural problem. Of course it is. It's deliberate, though. And it's a cultural problem which has been put there by the establishment in this country. It would be very, very simple for them to stop the boats if they really wanted to, but they don't want to. They want to create, you know, this has been going on, I think, for many, the British are very good at this over the years, at getting people fighting each other. They just simply want poor white people to fight poor black people.
Yeah.
Importing loads and loads of people with these little boats is a brilliant way to do it. It's also, by the way, I think the EU is very happy to see this, is it's a punishment for Brexit. You thought that you were going to be able to stop people coming across. Look what we can do. It's German boats they're bringing across, and it's the European Union's mafia who are supervising the whole thing. They're making sure it can happen. And there's hardly anybody in the British establishment who dares to stand up to, the, apart from apparently from Farage, you know, although I've got no faith in him whatsoever, that he will really do anything.
No, because but, he was delighted for years to get cheap labour.
It's a deliberate policy by white people to undermine the working classes, get poor people fighting each other, and also just to bring in loads and loads of cheap labour and prop up the house prices.
100%. I do agree with that. Don't take this the wrong way, because I love this stuff. What you've been writing about, what you talked about in terms of the evidence that has been uncovered, which seems to point to or prove that the Germans came up with the fusion and the capability of creating a nuclear bomb. Supposing this is absolute gospel, and it is hugely interesting, what difference do you think it makes in terms of us looking over the Second World War, what happened after? Why is it that important to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question. Why does it matter? The fact that it does, I mean, it matters immensely, I think, particularly if you happen to be Japanese. And the Japanese were, of course, allied with the Nazis. But the Nazis just decided, right, we're going to do a deal with the Yanks and we're going to nuke you now. You know, so but the most important thing, I think, to understand is the extent to which the technology and the personnel who've been working on all this stuff from Nazi Germany were brought to the United States. And it doesn't now seem so surprising that the United States is behaving like Nazi Germany, in that it thinks that it can invade and bomb any country, including Iran, the other week, on the planet, if it feels like it. And so, to me, the United States has got the best and the worst of everything. It's got some brilliant, fantastic people, but it's also the driver of the New World Order, and it's the driver of all these major wars. It has been, and along with the Brits. With my book that I did as well, I was pretty shocked when I realised that the British had done this deal with the Nazis at the end of the war, and that actually, you know, we decided to shake the hands of the Hitler's treasurer, basically Martin Bormann, bring him over here and help him escape any kind of punishment. So there was supposed to be a trial for him at Nuremberg, and he was tried in absentia, found guilty, and they demanded to be executed. And yet the Brits were protecting him at this point because he had amazing access to all of the loot that have been looted from Europe. So I think we need to really understand how the British and the Americans, this is why it's important, Richie, is to how the British and the Americans actually, for the final years of the war, were hand in glove with the Nazis, and they were already preparing, as Churchill wanted, to nuke Moscow to try and have a go at the Russians. So that's what we're now doing. We've now come full circle. We're now doing what some of the Nazis wanted to do during the Second World War. And we are much, much more deeply embedded. And the technology that is now coming to Britain, in fact, to Lakenheath in Suffolk, we hear last week from CND, sneakily the Starmer government is bringing in these nuclear bombs to Suffolk, and they haven't told anybody. CND is saying, well, look, we know they're there. Why don't you just fess up and say you've just brought these nuclear weapons back? You remember in the 1980s when the Americans brought nukes to Britain, we had Greenham Common, we had cruise missiles, we had hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets. And maybe that's what's going to happen when people realise that the Americans are now using us as their little aircraft carrier.
Here's a question. Are nuclear weapons dangerous when stored? Is there any danger in a local area if these things are stored in warehouses there, or are they fairly safe when they're just lying around?
Okay, put it this way. When a bomber crashed at Lakenheath years ago, American bomber with nukes on it, there were fires which were then put out. No, I mean, I think unless they're armed, which you have to arm one of these bombs,
what you would get is
even if it's in a fire and the explosives explode, you get a dirty bomb. So there wouldn't be a nuclear explosion unless the bomb has been armed, which they're only armed just before they're dropped. So they aren't, you know, they're not unlikely to go off by accident and blow up Lakenheath. No. But the fact is, of course, the Russians will be keeping a very close eye on this. And I would bet you that their intelligence, particularly with satellites, etc., and human intelligence, is good enough that they will know if the British are deciding that they want to launch a a nuclear attack on Russia. And by the way, we have been working with the Ukrainians to over the weekend to attack St. Petersburg with drones. The Russians, I don't know if you heard this, I think it was Don DeBar, the New York journalist I have on from time to time, said one of his Russian friends said over the weekend, the Russian main Channel 1 Russia political program, I think it was Saturday night, they were saying, oh, well, we're just getting these, we're testing these drones now for an attack on London. The Russians know where their main, which their main enemy is. And this is what I suppose I'm saying with the nukes in World War II, is the Brits and the Americans really are the problem. We are the problem. And that's why when people look at people like Starmer, they just despair and they think, well, what the hell is this guy doing there? He's not doing anything he was elected to do at all.
What Don told you, I'm sure Don believes it because he's a stand-up guy from hearing him on your programme, but I don't believe they're working on drones to reach London. I know you're going to hate me for saying it. I believe they're all controlled by the same entities, Putin and all of them. But that's just my opinion. Doesn't mean
right. I know, Richie.
It's just my shitty opinion. I know you don't agree. Here's
it's
Isabel.
It's not shitty. Look, it's
how I feel.
People have that opinion.
Yeah, I think they're all in the same club.
There is a genuine contest here between a kind of Masonic New World Order, secret societies organised within themselves, and particularly in Britain and America and the Grand Orient, Freemasonry on the continent in Europe. And the Chinese are another question. They're mostly secret society triads, but they are sort of almost like a mirror of the United States. And of course, they're not. There's no real. I was just watching a thing about President Xi, by the way, the other day. His history is pretty incredible. I mean, he basically got to the top just by being a backstabber, and now he's like the Pope. So if you criticise him, you can go to jail. But I do see the Russians as a genuine independent third force. And they are people who I think are pretty wily lot. Having visited Russia, chatted to lots of Russians over the years, they've got the measure of us.
You're a double agent.
With Trump or Starmer or the British establishment or anyone else. They point the finger all the time at the Brits right now, and I think they're right to do that.
You've just outed yourself as a double agent T. Agent T, 009. Hey, come here and I tell you, the reason I said shitty opinion, I'm not doing myself down. It feels shitty to think it, like to imagine that's the reality. Isabel has been in touch. This is good. She says, I read that Roosevelt hated Einstein, but allowed him to stay in America after Einstein gave lots of information about the Germans' atomic research and technology. Also, says Elizabeth, Isabel, Einstein was so worried about Germany owning the technology, he thought it was safer in the hands of the Americans. Is this something you've explored? Was Einstein hated by Roosevelt but was allowed to stay because he knew enough about the German research? What do you think?
Well, all I know about him is he was extremely disturbed by the Israeli state. Einstein was. He wrote several letters about the Irgun and the terrorists in Israel back in the 1940s, and he denounced the whole thing. He's one of those Jewish people who are right from the start were right onto the Zionists, saying no, this is not right, and it's not from a religious point of view. This is just from a scientific common sense point of view. And Todd Ryder, I was mentioning, is someone I think who had immense respect for Einstein as just a brilliant genius scientist who was actually born at the right time in order to be accepted and credited. I don't know if you've ever interviewed Dr. Chris Busby.
Yeah.
But he's one of those people. He's somebody who I think is an extremely talented, innovative, brilliant scientist who's prepared to think right outside the box in nuclear issues. And he can only get his stuff, often only get his stuff published in China. So it gets translated into Chinese, published over there. He gets paid for it. He cannot get his stuff published here because the media in the West is so controlled. They see him as a threat to the nuclear industry, quite rightly, because he is, because he's showing them up to be the scallywags and scoundrels that they are. And they're just on a gravy train, Richie. It's a massive, massive gravy train. Yeah. Right the way from the nuclear power industry right through to those bombs that go bang.
Here's one from Jan. We'll finish on this. By the way, folks, check out Tony's book, The Traitors of Arnhem. It's great. I have it here. There's about 9 books there in my little bookcase, and yours is one of them. Traitors of Arnhem, check it out. I'll put a link. No, it's a great read. Here's one from Jan. Don't explode now. What does Tony think of the theory that atomic bombs don't exist? Hang on, sorry, do exist, but not on the scale to cause the devastation in Japan, and maybe Hiroshima and Nagasaki were destroyed by carpet bombing and chemical weapons. Now, there are people who, and they're not loons, there are people who think that...
the film of what do you the Tsar bomber, I think it was at, one of the peninsulas on the north of Russia, they exploded that in the 1950s. I think it was 60-something megatons. This is a mass. I mean, it melts the ground like for thousands of feet into the surface. These things do exist. Of course they do. They work on the same principle as the fission reaction on the sun. Right. So that's what you've got basically going on. And in fact, in a weird way, of course, the worship of these things is like a kind of primitive sun worship. So the people who think they're so great can, you know, connect up with the druids and all these, you know, people from prehistory. So, in fact, I think, The Dying God, David Livingstone's book, is brilliant in all this. How he looks at this whole idea of sun worship, and as the sun goes down at night and comes up in the morning, this is all, you know, what your faith is all based on, this idea of resurrection of the sun in the morning, which in a way, I suppose, is, you know, is a reminder to us that when we wake up in the morning, oh, right, maybe there is an afterlife, you know. But anyway, the point is, yeah, you know, of course they exist. Yes, they do. The fact that they haven't been tested in the atmosphere is because, and I happen to know this, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, but I visited Cullum Laboratory back in the 1990s, that's south of Oxford, with a physicist there who showed me around for the day. And one of the things was the first time I ever saw email, actually, in the early 90s. And she explained to me, she said, well, look, the real, it's a fission, it's called the donut, it's a fission reactor. And they've got constant stuff on the media about, oh, fission. Look, it's rubbish. Or is it fusion? Sorry.
Fusion.
A fusion reactor donut. And she explained to me, she said, well, the nuclear weapons people love this place because in that donut, we can create the conditions of a nuclear explosion. So they can test out various materials to see how they react. So they don't need to do atmospheric tests. They do them down at these fusion reactors. So that's the purpose. It's all under the cover of a civil program, but actually it's nuclear weapons development.
We have been reminded by William Henderson, shame on both of us for not remembering this. Einstein was offered the presidency of Israel, of course, in the early 1950s. The stipulation was, if my memory serves, he had to go and live there. But he turned it down. 'Twas after the death of Weizmann, wasn't
good
it?
Man.
Yeah. We're right out of time. I don't even have time to
That's
read comments.
That's like John Lennon turning down his OBE, isn't it?
Yeah, turning down the OBE.
Like, up yours, mate. You know, who do you think I am? You're not using me for public relations, thank you.
Catch Tony on Friday, 5 p.m. That is British summertime on Not the BCFM Politics Show, live out of Bristol. It's terrific. Thanks for today, pal.
Okay, and I thoroughly recommend having a look at that. I mean, if you go to my Rumble channel, I've got some of the Todd Ryder stuff up there. But if you just look for Hidden History, Todd Ryder, you will find some of the most mind-blowing presentations. There's such an amazing amount of work. I think in the years to come, this is going to become common knowledge because he's done all of the digging, all the groundwork to explain that the threat of nuclear weapons is really cooked up by the Nazis in the Second World War.
Speak to you very soon. It'll be in September.
Thanks, Richie.
Always a pleasure, mate. God bless you. Tony Gosling, live from Bristol on The Richie Allen Show.